multiple regions of esports. Everyone from established regions to growing regions to everyone in between. And we're going to give some really interesting thoughts and perspectives on this so everyone can understand the decisions behind it, the challenges that they run into, and where the future is really looking. So, down the line, will you please introduce yourselves, let us know who you are, what you do, and what brought you to esports.
Hi, my name is Lisa Hansen. I'm the managing partner and founder of Nico Partners. We're a market research firm focused on the games industry in Asia. We're approaching 18 years old, and so we've watched the evolution of digital games in China, Southeast Asia, Korea, Japan, and so forth for all that time. And I think how it can be esports is that, in my opinion, Asia is the heart of esports globally, which is making it kind of ironic that it's called an emerging market. But yeah.
My name is Arnold Herr. I'm the COO at Gen G Esports. We're a global esports organization in the top titles, around the top esports titles in the world, in the top esports markets in the world, Los Angeles, the US, Shanghai in China, and Seoul in Korea.
I noticed my name got cut off there. So my name is Joe James, and I'm Trade Commissioner for Games and Esports with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Finland. And a lot of people ask me, is that a thing? It is a thing as of March this year. So I joined the ministry. I'm based in Los Angeles. Before that, I worked in the private sector in the games industry in Finland for 10 years. And now I'm trying to build partnerships between the Finland and the U.S.
I'm Ari Siegel. I introduced myself earlier. I think what brought me to esports was two things. One, at a high level, it was the people and the opportunities. So I saw all these really accomplished investor operators and brands that were trying to figure out a way to get into the fastest growing segment of media. And then at a micro level, my background is in pro hockey. Obviously not a player. The biggest challenge that hockey faces is the relationship between playing and watching. And all the challenges that hockey confronts, esports and gaming really elegantly solves naturally. And so given that this thing had been a thorn in my side for the last 8 years, I thought esports would be a walk in the park, which of course is not.
Awesome, and thank you for the introductions. Because each of you have a particular focus, I'm going to ask some person-specific questions, but ultimately, if any of you have something to add, we'd love to hear it. So, Lisa, to kick things off, because you made the right point that China isn't necessarily emerging, can you tell us a little bit, like a super quick history of how long they've been active, or what does their leadership look like?
Well, we look at China and Southeast Asia as this cohesive unit that has a huge set of gamers. In fact, throughout Asia, we're probably looking at a billion gamers. And through those gamers, even in China, where we have about 600 million gamers, roughly 80% of them say that they engage or view esports. So that's a lot of people. And when we think about them, they engage by either being spectators or participants, or there are Twitch competitive platforms, because Twitch itself is not there, but Douyu or Huya, some other platforms are there. And throughout Southeast Asia, we see other opportunities for people to engage. But there's an internet cafe culture, which one could argue preceded esports by having kind of the opportunity for team-based play or community play or local friend play side by side in an area where consoles were not prominent, and in the case of China, not legal for a long time. So we had a lot of local player opportunity on console heavy nations, but in areas in Asia where that was not true, this iCafe opportunity kind of walked the user base toward esports, and when the games hit the market, they were a ready audience for it.
Now, when you talk about Southeast Asia, would that be an emerging region, or would there be some emerging opportunities there? But also, can you help us understand what countries?
Yeah, in alphabetical order, the countries we cover are Indonesia, Malaysia, Philippines, Singapore, Thailand, and Vietnam. We also cover China, Taiwan, and we cover mainland China. To a certain extent, we look at Japan and Korea as well, and opportunity at one level or another. But what is universally true, with the exception maybe of India, is that what motivates gamers to play games are the tenets that make up the essence of esports. So things like competition, community, challenge, and completion, the ability to complete a session, which all conveniently start with C, so I call those the four C's, and those are some primary motivators of most gamers throughout Asia, and that is why we know that esports is not a bubble in Asia, and also helps define why gamers are so attracted to competitive gameplay, both to play and observe, and why the games that are played in esports competitions have the highest revenue out of and the longest tail of engagement of all the titles.
And what are some of those games? And are they consistent across China and Southeast Asia? Or are there hotspots?
The games kind of vary. Dota is really popular because it's lower cost to play. There's a game called Free Fire, which is super hot on mobile, coming out of Southeast Asia and also really hot in Brazil and some other markets. Honor of Kings is wildly popular. It's known as Arena of Valor outside of China. There's usual League of Legends, PUBG, all the rest of it there. You'd find some of the hottest titles outside from the West are available throughout Asia and are also popular, but there are lots of homegrown titles there as well.
So this is an interesting question I have for you, because for the longest time we've seen this incredible viewership numbers out of China across any major esports events. Now, when I talk to some OGs in esports, they some even doubt those numbers, but also the academic numbers are stupid. And you're like, well, I'm more inclined to believe those numbers. Can you help validate some of that? Is the scale actually there? Are people just being silly or defensive? Arnold, that might be too, so
well,
feel free to jump in.
Yeah, sorry, I feel like this is if you have 600 million gamers and 80% of them claim self-avowed and they participate or spectate esports, then a lot of the viewership numbers you hear about can be true. You know, even in 2017, the League of Legends World Championships held at the Bird's Nest Stadium that you might remember from the Olympics in Beijing. A huge stadium had 40,000 seats filled, but 57 million people viewing at the same time. And then that could be from anywhere, but even the local tournaments, they get a huge amount of viewership, and there are streaming platforms that go public and more so, and it's all because of how popular their gaming channels are.
Because we've heard that there's about five or six platforms that are the size of Twitch, perhaps more, in the Asian market.
I'm sure that's true.
Okay, no worries. I would love to actually bring over, because we're speaking of Asia, you are a team that has rosters in the US, Korea, and China. Can you help us understand a little bit of the motivation there?
Yeah, so people always think, you know, it's some sort of like master plan, or, you know, genius is out there or something like that. But it's really not that complicated, right? If you look at the esports world, and I mean, you said the same thing. Like US, I mean, Korea and China are not emerging markets. If you look at the largest esports market in the world, it's China. Number two is US, number three is Korea. So we're in the top three markets and the top titles. That seems to make a lot of sense for us, right? Esports is global. And you know, to your point on kind of the China fake streaming numbers, I mean, generally, so we actually have a team of Koreans that are actually like international stars. They have a huge following in China, actually. The biggest fan base is actually in China, and a little bit here in LA, actually, or Vegas, I guess, in LA, actually. To the point, and we work directly in stream, and where we're using, you know, the TikTok equivalent, which is Douyin in China. We'll post a video, and immediately, within a day, one of our players got in Pina. He's considered, I guess, pretty cute or something, and he gets 4 million views in a day, right, just from that clip. But the one thing about the streaming platforms is that you have to really be there to understand what's really going on. So we directly stream and have direct relationships with Huya, Douyin, as well as Douyu, the streaming platforms in China. So right now the rule is actually you divide that number by 8. So that's what they tell you. Actually, if you have a good enough relationship, you get the China number, divide by 8. By next year it might be 12, it might be 7, but you gotta know. Like, you gotta have that relationship, because you'll never know otherwise. But we are noticing some really unique trends. So China, You have huge government investment coming in. They're really, really supporting the infrastructure behind what an esport is. And the thinking behind it is that, you know, when, as the Chinese economy begins to lag because of, you know, let's say, certain trade issues that are happening, the government actually views this as a great way to kind of keep younger people occupied to do stuff, right? In Korea, what's happening is we are actually seeing that a lot of our players, we have actually kind of a much more advanced culture in Korea. One of the more unique things is we ran an esports event where we had a fan meeting and just an exhibition match for our Seoul Dynasty team. And we sold 1,500 tickets within the first 90 seconds, priced anywhere from $50 all the way up to $200. 90% of those tickets were actually to women because they're almost viewed as like idols. So, you know, we're seeing a really unique trend there where it's actually becoming much more mainstream than you see in the U.S. And then in the U.S., I think, you know, what we're noticing here is, I think, really interesting, right? Like, number one, we're calling the Asian markets emerging when they've already emerged. Number two, the way I kind of view where the U.S. is, I think we're really leading on media. Like, I love the fact that it's on ESPN, that it's on ABC. We're really leaning towards, you know, taking the lead around PR and media to the point where now I think we're seeing a trend where I like to think of it as, you know, the C-level guy goes and finds the you know, whoever reports to them on marketing and says, go figure out esports. The person in marketing has no idea what esports is and just tries to find the youngest guy on the team and ask, hey, what is esports? So I feel like that's kind of where the stage of where the U.S. is.
Sure.
So I've been really thinking about, you know, it's really interesting kind of seeing all those three markets together. And I thought for us, it's a really unique way for us to kind of package us as a unique asset in the esports world.
Well, you mentioned something particularly interesting where you saw the media presence in the U.S. as a strength compared to the rest of the world. So maybe if you can compare and contrast where else other strengths are in other countries, maybe some weaknesses that we could all learn from.
Yeah, so I would say the weaknesses are that in Korea and in China, it's kind of like you have just a huge gap between kind of like the older population as well as the younger population. The younger population fully accepts esports as sports, right? I always say, you know, I was born in LA, born and raised, but I've always thought that it was really cool that, you know, Korea is not that great at team sports, right? We're probably never going to beat the U.S. in basketball. But we're going to kick ass in League of Legends every year, right? So, you know, for me, it's a little state of pride, right? And it's a state of pride for any young Korean. So in terms of that, the one weakness there is there's a huge gap between an actual, let's say, where the parent generation of what they, you know, think success is, being a lawyer, being a doctor, when, you know, what the younger people see is that I went to law school and I don't have a job. Right, so you're seeing that huge gap, and that's one thing that we've actually started to address. We've actually started an esports academy, one that includes both a, you know, you basically go in the morning and learn esports, and in the afternoon you're actually getting a U.S. high school education. So it's a really unique asset where we're able to really give.
That's in Korea or China?
In Korea for now, but we plan to expand. And so we get to really kind of show younger people that there could be a path where you can get a great, you know, scholarship into a U.S. university, and while still not trying to go full pro and probably failing, and still getting your U.S. high school degree. So I think that's where there's a clear divide versus, I think, in the U.S. You have much more acceptance that you can kind of do both. That you can go to school. Hey, look, if you're good, if you kind of move your spare time, maybe you'll turn pro, maybe not. So it's less of a binary decision. So I feel like the culture here is more accepting of more division of time.
So now that you have three teams across these regions and you have an overarching organization, is there any kind of cross-promotional content you can do from all of them? Or is it just you have to recognize that if your Korean team's part of China, you just focus on that? I'd just love to hear more about those marketing decisions and how to balance all of those regions.
Sure, and there's two things, right? I think about, you know, when we do big sponsorship deals, one of the more unique assets that we have is, hey, you know, you're doing a global sponsorship with us in China, Korea, and the U.S., we can talk to your regional offices. Because usually the C-level guy makes a decision, and then it gets kicked out, and they have no idea what this thing is, right? So a great example would be, you know, I can't say this now because they haven't announced it yet, but let's say you do a big deal, and then you work with the local China office, we work with the local Korea office, and we work with the U.S. office, and then try to make sure we activate very, very differently and uniquely. And when we find content that works in cross regions, then we actually go and explode that up.
Examples of that?
So a good example is actually TikTok. We actually have now started what we call a TikTok farm out of China. What they do is they just go and watch clips and try to figure out like what they think could be viral, and then just start feeding those clips, you know, using Dropbox Advanced or Box. So Box to all of our marketing teams across the board. Because we said, look, you know, unfortunately or fortunately, hiring somebody to do that in the US, they don't make that many clips for you, and they cost a lot, versus in China, for whatever reason, you know, it's a lot cheaper, right? So we try to figure out like, where we can find those unique efficiencies. But we let each market decide what that best content is, really shape the narrative, and then activate the sponsors so that it makes sense to the local consumer. So, you know, it's always like that cheesy term, like think globally, act locally kind of thing.
As we've seen it before in ACC World, globally.
I'd love to hate, but you have to use this. So yeah, so that's kind of one of the unique things that, you know, we use as our advantages. You know, we're able to strike these big global deals using our more senior kind of corporate team, and then we go and activate them locally so that it actually seems authentic to gamers and to brands and to, you know, young people.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. Thank you. So, Trisha, a couple questions for you, particularly around the Finnish activities. We talked about this before when we were prepping for this date. There's some actually really interesting numbers coming out from around the pro output, the pro players that for some reason Finland is really good outputting. But if you give us like a couple seconds to ramp us up on what Finns have been doing in esports world.
Yeah, sure. It's also interesting. I was thinking about the same notion earlier. Is it an emerging market? Is it not? So because Finland has actually a very, very strong gaming DNA. And in terms of competitive gaming as a hobby, it's been around since 95 or more. The first assembly event, which is actually the largest like LAN party and slash now they're obviously like more esports tournaments and that kind of stuff. It's been around since 95, but commercially it's emerging for sure. There are not a lot of commercially successful teams, truly global teams, besides Ents that's making real revenue. But still, what is one thing that Finland's been really, really good at, and I always like to draw this parallel between the games industry as a whole, which is it's quite incredible that it's in I think it was like in 2016 or something, it's now 2.5 billion, it's 2 billion in revenue at a time, but that's basically 3,000 people generated 5% of, you know, global like sales in the mobile app store. There was like 2 billion in revenue in the games market. And so Finns are really, really good at creating insane amount of value with small teams, right? Like small, potent, quality over quantity type of thinking. And so but you know, going back to how it translates to the numbers in esports, so you can look at it, and I wanted to say this that there's like three Finns in the top 10 highest earning, but the third one is in the 11th. So I'm going to call it the top 11 list. But anyway, the top 11 highest earners, there's just three Finns basically. It's quite, and also in the top 10 like highest earning like by, you know, by country, Finland is the 10th, so 22 million or something. And that's with, you know, with 1,300 or 1,400 players. So I know you asked me about like calculate the per capita thing, but I didn't have the time. But it's anyway, it sounds like that there is something, there's a lot of talent in Finland, but it's emerging from a commercial standpoint for a number of reasons that I'm sure we're going to touch on.
And that's really what I'm curious about, because we're joking, like, is there some kind of per capita number? Because Finland's population is, what, 5.5 million?
5.5, yeah.
And out of all the pros versus all the other countries in the world, like, that actually could be a pretty high number.
Yeah, I think it is. If somebody wants to do the math, feel
free. No worries. So let's actually talk about, because there's Finns that have been so good in game development and outputting stuff, what are the first things that, if you were to look at more investment in esports in Finland, where would you start? Is it more leagues, more activities? activity or community levels, amateur levels, more teams? Is there something that, because there's a lot. I'd love for you to kind of walk us through it. You're seeing that, thank you too.
I would say all of the above. but truly, I was thinking about this as well. The reality is that in Finland the ecosystem is still very new. It's very fragmented. There's a lot of opportunity across all those areas. One of the key things in talking with people back home that comes up consistently time after time is capital and the lack of capital into teams and leagues and basically the ability for these really talented hobbyists to turn this into a career, into a meaningful career that actually, you know, pays the bills. And you know, a lot of that has to do with just in general, not enough, you know, not enough money going around, I think, in the esports industry in general. Obviously, the biggest question for most people, where is the value? Where is, you know, where is the long-term, sustainable, scalable business model that actually warrants the type of investment that some of these businesses would need. And then, of course, on the flip side, it's also that sort of commercial thinking from the team's perspective and the challenge of figuring out how to monetize products and services and then actually create those business technologies. Now, one of the things that actually, again, Finland has been really good at on the games industry side is figuring out technology plays and how to sort of like scale on the technologies. How to find basically the scalable components and innovation in any new business vertical. And so there is a big sort of push right now, actually from the government side, an initiative that's underway of actually, which is partially public funded, to figure out where is the sort of like value creation, what's the value creation in esports, how can brands actually find value in esports.
Now, it's one of my questions is because Finland's associated game development that we've seen, is there a potential for competitive title to be developed? Is that something that some of the studios are looking at? Is that something that we can or cannot talk about?
They already may have been doing. Obviously the obvious answer is that there are already titles out there that our previous panelists have talked about. Supercell being, you know, one of the biggest companies in the world, arguably, and their titles translate very well to esports. But there are also a couple of companies, Nitro Games and Gribble Force and some others that are developing and actively looking into, you know, and are developing esports titles. And there are others as well that are working on this. And now this is actually also something that where sort of where Finland has a unique competitive advantage, I think, in my completely objective opinion. But in the sense that because there is that very, very strong, tight-knit community and knowledge sharing in the game space, and an incredible talent pool amongst creators and publishers, so what we're going to see, and I hope to see, and actually this weekend on the 14th is our first large international CSGO tournament called Arctic Invitational. Where they're also going to unveil like 5G mobile gaming, or 5G gaming as part of the whole experience. And so I think that because I'm gonna say like 70 or 80% of developers in Finland are mobile focused, so I definitely want to see a lot more publishers specifically creating competitive mobile titles and creating, you know, basically supporting the esports industry from that perspective.
I appreciate it, thank you. So all right, I'd love to kind of pick your brain about some of the specifics that you mentioned earlier as part of your keynote, that you doubled down on Brazil as an obvious direction for you. I'm more curious about the staffing portion of that, just how you handle managing your teams. Any challenges and nuances there, anything that we could learn from for those in another team that wants to do that, or another league that wants to grow in another region? Any challenge there?
Really?
I love that confidence.
Yeah, no, it's very challenging. So what we've tried to do as a business in our IBC Esports operating company is,
instead of trying to aggregate audience, as many of our peer organizations have under kind of an autonomous brand, we've tried to go more niche with brands that resonate with a narrower subset of the community. And so, as kind of Arnold was explaining to you, Gen Z's unique value proposition to brands is bringing together the top three markets under one umbrella, right? Creating an entry point that gets you scale into markets. We are able to get brands scale across our brands, but we're hopefully, if we're doing our job correctly, able to go deeper within any of our individual brands. So our MIBR brand means something very different than our Valiant brand. And our MIBR brand is the one that we staff out of both Los Angeles and Brazil for three different reasons. Number one, we have a Brazilian staff that is Portuguese native language speaking, grew up in Sao Paulo, lives in the offices with Gamers Club, and is really, truly endemic, not just to esports, but to the MIBR brand and experience. What does that mean? What does it mean to be made in Brazil? It would be really strange if the people that we're evangelizing for that brand were not Brazilian. We've complemented our CSGO team with a Rainbow Six team because the games are culturally similar. They're both FPS, so MIBR is a little bit of an FPS genre game, and also because Rainbow Six for us right now gives us some additional inventory that we can cross-sell against with MIBR. You know, our MIBR players are higher profile, CSGO is a game that's more developed. The ability of our players in MIBR who spend 200 plus days every year traveling is limited. But having our Rainbow Six team that's MIBR on the ground in Brazil all the time gives us a mechanism through which we can activate very, very frequently. So we have our MIBR players that are doing dual language content and participating and traveling globally that are co-managed by a Brazilian manager who travels with them, and then our American staff. But then we also have our Rainbow Six team that is in Brazil full-time that's managed fully by our Brazilian staff. And I think that that's been a really good solution for us.
So how's Portuguese by now?
Not existing.
So what's really interesting?
Management is delegated.
Fair enough, you hire the right people, thank you.
So let's actually talk about the branding, because you have how many different brands now under the umbrella?
Four. And well, plus Gamers Club, so five.
Gotcha. So any other brands show other within other regions? Or is it just Brazil's brand? Like MIBR is just Brazil, the rest are global, the rest are American.
So the way that I would articulate it is we often get the question of how do you guys think about entering a game? And we think about it a little bit differently in the sense that we're looking for white spaces. And it could be a white space within our portfolio. For example, we're definitely scouring the market for what's going to be the next culturally relevant mobile game in North America. That's a gaming hole in our portfolio. I think Clash Royale does some things really well, but I don't think it's achieved the scale Honor of Kings in China, for example. And so it doesn't resonate the way that Honor of Kings does in China. So in the event that we see a white space opportunity as it relates to game participation, we will look for what is the right brand fit. So we're not taking a top-down approach and saying, if we're going to go into a game, well, it's under Immortals. Because the Immortals brand might not be the right fit for that market, for that audience, for that customer segment, or that publisher. And what we've actually found is, you know, there are certain brands that have preferences or aversions to various content. The kind of archetypal example of that would be brands that just are avoiding first-person shooter red blood games. If you have one brand, I don't think that publisher, that brand is going to care if they're only doing your Overwatch team. If the same brand would be associated with Counter-Strike, that could be problematic. So there's an elegant solution there. But in any case, back to your question, we think about what is the white space that we're trying to attack, and what is the combination of game participation and or other activity combined with brand that will make us differentiated within that white space. If it's truly white, hopefully one of the points of differentiation is that we're the first mover.
Got it, I really appreciate that walkthrough. A question for essentially the two teams on RA. Is there something that you would share with another team looking to do the same with another region? What's the first piece of advice that you would give them? Don't, yes, maybe, what is it?
And the advice that I would give, Arnold, curious what your opinion is, oftentimes I think people are afraid that the world is distributed. And the truth is, one of the great things about being in gaming, whether you're in esports or game development or anything else, is the pie is growing. So there's so much space for Arnold and I to have a similar strategy deployed in different markets and to trade stories and secrets and best practices and to help each other. We're not cannibalizing each other by both succeeding. And it's also true that people can attack geography with a different approach to branding. Gen G is a massively bigger brand than Immortals globally. And that's okay, that doesn't mean one is better or one is worse. So I guess what I would say is there's a group of us on the team side that work well together and talk very frequently and think that there's strength in numbers.
From my perspective, you know, I think in terms of advice for anybody else looking to expand is you gotta make sure it's real, right? Like you can't halfway go. That's one of the reasons why I respect Ari's decisions and where they're going all in into it, right? There's a lot of folks out there that will say they have international coverage and have no idea, they have no boots on the ground, right? They're not actually physically traveling and figuring it out in those regions, right? But that's just not gonna work, right? So, you know, the pie is growing, but you have to make sure that you're partnering with the folks that are genuinely there, that are genuinely caring, that are genuinely making it work. Otherwise, you know, I think for anybody looking to also expand into kind of some of these international markets, you know, really trust is really big, right? Because there's been a ton of stories of people that say that they know this or know this, but they end up doing something terrible, right? Or if you can't trust them, you can't. Every single interaction with them is going to be very difficult. Like, as I already said, the pie is growing, and in that kind of growing market, you just want to find the people that you trust to make the right decisions. Because even if the first thing misses, then the second thing, the third thing, you guys, as long as you guys keep learning and figuring it out and you trust each other, it's going to work, right? So I feel like that's one of the best things that, you know, I started my career at Goldman Sachs, actually, in mortgage-backed securities and trading. And the one thing that I learned, besides kind of price CDOs, was the trend is your friend, right? And so in a growing market, it's all about just finding who you want to work with, who you can act fast with, and who you can capture the opportunity quickly.
Thank you, and I really, really appreciate that insight. At least maybe this is a question for you, but also everybody. What are some of those white spaces right now? From a game, from a platform, or a region? Is there something that these folks should be looking at because your hands are full? Have someone else do it, or something that you could also tap with someone else?
Well, I think I'm going to answer a different question. I'm going to, I want to tell a couple of anecdotes about some experiences I've observed in Asia, which I think is a roundabout way to answer your question, but things that we might not think are commonplace here or in the West that are really fun to see in Asia. First is, you mentioned Honor of Kings is, you know, huge, and it is. And one of the reasons, though, is because it has more than 50% female participation. So if you find a title that can have more than 50% participation, then this pie that everybody wants to grow, it's just naturally starting at a bigger point and growing bigger from there. So when I say Honor of Kings, I don't just mean the title in China, but I also mean AOE, which is outside of China, same title. The second thing is that, like, when we see the government support, which has been mentioned here for, and that's really, it's critical, but, you know, some Asian countries are calling esports their national sport. The newly elected president of Indonesia, his son just became part of a professional esports team. And the president ran on a platform promoting esports in Indonesia. So he got a huge swath of the young voters to say, wow, this guy's forward thinking, right? And then another instance that we can see, and across China, like you said, there's a whole bunch of different government initiatives to build arenas, build little sections of towns, build amusement parks, all based on the themes of games or esports. But one of my favorite stories is this company called Air Asia, which is a super popular low-budget airline based out of Malaysia. And Alan Fong, he tells a great tale. And I spoke at the World Cyber Games finals. They had an esports conference in Xi'an, China, and I saw somebody wearing a shirt from right there. And yeah, so this was in Xi'an, China, not very long ago, this summer. And Alan Fong was another speaker. And he showed this amazing slideshow and talked about the experience of Air Asia getting into esports. Well, not only has esports just galvanized every smart person in Malaysia to want to work at AirAsia because they have an esports club and they have they sponsor esports teams, and now they have like basically this esports farm going on through their company. They're coming up with a lot of what I think would be the white space to answer your question, a lot of innovation around the intersection of esports and tourism, which is a big deal in Asia. So you have the promotion of a government entity, the tourist board, say of Singapore, saying that they want to help the ESL have a tournament in Singapore, and then partner with a budget airline to bring young gamers there and have it all work cohesively together. And then there's posters all over the town, everybody benefits, the restaurants are happy, the hotels are thrilled, and esports becomes like the poster child of bringing the younger generation on a tourist trip around Asia. So AirAsia has developed not only esports internally, but now they're even considering about running tournaments on their flights across Asia. And they go out into the public, and they, you know, in the absence of arenas, or perhaps despite there being arenas, they'll set do a pop-up tournament in the middle of a retail mall just for fun. And they'll put screens up, and then all the stores in the mall are delighted because it attracts all these young buyers and who watch the activity go on with the esports tournament. They go shop in the stores, they go buy a soda, whatever it is they do. And I think the white space in the West that I've observed, although I tell you, I live in California, in Silicon Valley, and I focus all day, every day on Asia, so I'm kind of a terrible judge of this. But I think that until until the governments here can support and watch some of these trends, the white space of, say, the intersection of tourism or the development of other, the growth of ancillary industries around esports, just where the physical location is, or even mobile esports, which is super hot in Asia, hotter than PC esports, one could argue, growing faster. You know, I think that those are some of the trends that I'm watching that would be amazing to see happen here.
That's super quick, because we have a few minutes. Anyone else want to add to that?
To her point, you know, one of the things that I think is a white space that's not just in Asia but all around the world is actually women in gaming. It's kind of right across the hall right there. We don't consider ourselves that smart. We just look at the world based on facts, and we look at Fortnite, we've got a huge female player base, and we notice that no esports teams are really working to try to develop the best female team, right? So we jumped in, actually. And we believe, I'm 99.999% sure, that we have the world's best female Fortnite team today. And they place higher than any other women, and they place, and they compete against men. I think recently we placed 35th in the world in this competition that we were in. So, there's a huge opportunity there that's right in front of us that, you know, nobody's really taking advantage of. And I think the other thing, too, is that, like, when you go and take advantage of that white space, you'll often find that there are tangential white spaces that naturally attract. A good example is we actually ended up partnering with Bumble. One of the things that they got really excited about was Bumble's a dating app. I guess you're married to the
country. No, I'm not married. Oh, but just for the folks who don't know.
Yeah, it's like you're a little older. One of the things that they found out is that, hey, you know what, gaming, the other white space is that gaming is about connecting with people. It's actually no longer about, like, when I played, I was like sitting in my room, playing by myself, pretty sad. But now you're actually going and like connecting with people and making friends in real life, right? So a great example is we actually launched a feature with Bumble, and they have a friend finding feature, and then eventually I'm sure it'll expand. But you can actually find other gamers in your area and try to make friends that way, right? So it's a really unique angle that we're able to see. One of the things is I remember a lot of parents would often forbid their kids from playing games. At this point, it's like forbidding your kid from having recess, right? Like, so there's a really connection layer here. I guess the two spaces, just to sum up, are kind of women in gaming and really finding those areas where people aren't looking. The other is that kind of realizing that it's a connection that's happening in gaming and really taking that white space and figuring that out. I think it are two gigantic opportunities.
Thank you so much.
And so, just super quick, 35 seconds. Okay. just to add to that, like two points, two additional spaces that at least I want to see more of, and in Finland, it's just recently there was a research from last year in Finland, actually amongst the 18 to 29 cohort men. Like esports has overtaken ice hockey in terms of interest. Three-fourths of people interested in esports in Finland were under 45, and it's like 11% of the population, so it's like 500,000 people or a bit over. And that's growing. And so it's really, what I want to see is to tap into this interest, this growing interest that's clearly it's a trend that's growing at the inception, right? So where it happens when with young people. This particular research, by the way, didn't take it cut off at 18, which I thought was, well, that's great. So we're not seeing a huge a segment of the population that's super super interested in esports, obviously, and tapping into their passion and actually offering them a way to from a very early age to get into this. So obviously, if they want to keep this a hobby, perfectly fine. But for those who want to turn this into a career, offering them a clear career path.
I would just give a super specific actionable, which is if you're looking to do something in an emerging market, I would focus on infrastructure. Often in emerging markets, per capita income is lower than in more mature industrialized nations. And there are tons, millions of people in these places that are looking to play games, looking to compete, looking to connect, and infrastructure can help do that work.
All right, awesome. Do we have time for a couple questions? Can we swing it?
Go ahead. One really, really good question. Who's got it? No pressure. All right, he raised his hand. Let's go.
So, just a briefly, Esports Stadium in Arlington. I'm interested in the types of events that are in Asia generally attract crowds, tens of thousands, some of them hundreds of thousands. We don't see yet those size of crowds in the United States. What do you think is the one thing that's missing or the one thing that needs to evolve in the West to make esports as large a draw or a larger draw than it is now to start seeing the larger crowds of like events?
Well, I would say it's not really something creatable in that way. I could only kind of explain that gaming is the lowest cost form of social entertainment that is available in these markets where there's not as much disposable income. And they've had the opportunity to have internet cafes and their friends, and this is their social way of being. And in the West, especially the United States, you look around, you've got so much choice. You've got so many opportunities. Going to the movies, you say, wow, that's $11, but I have $11. But in Asia, that's a lot of money, and it's the same price. So I think that we started off with the opportunity to serve an audience social entertainment that they needed, that they could afford, and that took off. So here, in order to catch up, so to speak, you know, create the environment where people could gather casually, be it on pop-up mobile tournaments, or perhaps try to infuse the internet cafes into society again somehow just for these opportunities, or really jump on the bandwagon of what's going on at the universities, which is thrilling. It's really exciting what's happening in the universities and the colleges. Those people will have the same inherent understanding of the opportunities for social entertainment as the huge populations in Asia have, and I think you build it from there.
Cool. Anyone else? Good. All right. That is it. Please, big round of applause, not just for this time, but everybody who's been here today. Thank you so much for coming. If you have any questions, please.